The stone won't fall until the podcast of the dragon comes to your device. Hey everybody, my name is Morgan. You might know me as the Grey Warder on Twitter and Discord. Welcome to the 17th episode of Podcast of the Dragon. Would it surprise you to find out that Rand has daddy issues? Shocking, I know. Today I'm wrapping up the Great Hunt by going all Freud on the dragon and finding out why he's so determined to insist that he's from the Two Rivers, even as it becomes more and more obvious that he isn't. Hey, if you want to say you're from the Two Rivers, go ahead, Bran. Which Two Rivers? Dateron and Denial. Even if you like Rand Althor, and I do, I like him very, very much. He is a frustrating character. All of the characters in the Wheel of Time are frustrating, but with 20% of the total word count in the series and an overwhelming word count, like he's the dominating POV in the first two books, Rand is one of the most frustrating of our main characters, at least before he has his epiphany in Veins of Gold. There are lots of reasons that he infuriates me. He's arrogant, he's a shithead, he is overconfident, and he is poisoned by toxic masculinity. He makes stupid choices, it's endless, and I often want to smother him with a pillow. But that's later. In the first two books, it's less about him being an arrogant shithead and more just that he's a dumbass. He doesn't start out as a shithead. He's often aggravatingly headstrong, but for the most part, he's a sweet kid. The significant point being that he's a kid, and you expect young people to be dumbasses. And it seems to be a defining characteristic of the Two Rivers boys, particularly with Matt and Rand, to be dumbasses and make stupid choices. And while that can be exasperating, really, Rand's most frustrating characteristic in the first two books is his stubborn self-delusion, manifested in his insistence that Tam is his father, and the inherent refusal in that to accept that he is the dragon. They're intertwined. He cannot accept the latter without letting go of the former. While listening to the repetitive inner narrative that he has of Tam is my father, I'm not the dragon. Tam is my father, I'm not the dragon. My name is Rand Althor. It's so irritating, and if you take it at face value, a person just might say to themselves, Jesus, RJ, I get the fucking point. But the foundation for that frustrating roadblock in Rand's brain is laid really subtly and skillfully in the very first chapter of The Eye of the World. And it's so subtly and skillfully laid that I have read these early books literally dozens of times, and I only just found it while I was going back and looking for Tam is my father quotes. It says, when they saw Tam, the good wives of Emmons Field went on point like hounds spotting a rabbit. There was not a one of them who did not know just the perfect wife for a widower with a good farm, even if it was in the Westwood. Rand stepped along just as quickly as Tam, perhaps even more so. He was sometimes cornered when Tam was not around, with no way to escape outside of rudeness. Herded onto a stool by the kitchen fire, he would be fed pastries or honey cakes or meat pies, and always the good wife's eyes weighed and measured him as neatly as any merchant's scales and tapes, while she told him that what he was eating was not nearly so good as her widowed sister's cooking or her next-to-eldest cousin's. Tam was certainly not getting any younger, she would say. It was good that he had loved his wife so. It boded well for the next woman in his life, but he had mourned long enough. Tam needed a good woman. It was a simple fact, she would say, or something very close, that a man just could not do without a woman to take care of him and keep him out of trouble. Worst of all were those who paused thoughtfully at about that point, then asked with elaborate casualness exactly how old he was now. Like most Two Rivers folk, Rand had a strong, stubborn streak. Outsiders sometimes said it was the prime trait of people in the Two Rivers that they could give mules lessons and teach stones. The good wives were fine and kindly women for the most part, but he hated being pushed into anything, and they made him feel as if he were being prodded with sticks. So he walked fast and wished Tam would hurry Bella along. So we're told right away in the first chapter of the first book that the Aes Sedai are not going to get what they want from Rand. Basically, no one is. He's not going to do what he's told. He's not going to let anybody push him around, and he's not going to see anything that he doesn't want to see. He's not going to come to terms with anything that he's not ready to come to terms with. We also in this passage get a glimpse of him and his father navigating a familiar gauntlet where people, quote-unquote well-meaning people, and well-meaning is often just a euphemism for presumptuous people, try to encroach or force another person into the citadel that is their relationship. I don't think it's just that Tam is still mourning his wife. I think it's that he enjoys the dynamic that is just the two of them. He knows they absolutely do not need a woman to care for them. He's doing a fine job raising his son on his own, thank you, and Rand does not need another mother. The expectation involved in Two Rivers' gender roles means a new wife or a stepmom for Rand would settle into their small house and take over tasks that they have to do for themselves, even though they're traditionally women's tasks, and she would squeeze Rand and Tam out of spaces that they fill in a perfectly comfortable fashion. Rand describes the main room. If the room did not look quite so freshly scrubbed as most farm wives kept their homes, Tam's pipe rack and the travels of Jane Forrestrider sat on the table, while another wood-bound book rested on the cushion of his reading chair, a bit of harness to be mended lay on the bench by the fireplace, and some shirts to be darned made a heap on a chair. If not quite so spotless, it was still clean and neat enough, with a lived-in look that was almost as warming and comforting as the fire. Here it was possible to forget the chill beyond the walls. There was no false dragon here, no wars or Aes Sedai, no men in black cloaks. The aroma from the stew pot hanging over the fire permeated the room and filled Rand with ravenous hunger. These two guys are doing just fine. They can cook, they can darn their own clothes, if you can mend harness, you can sew. You have to, as a soldier, know how to do a whole bunch of tasks. As you see it later on, as Matt is dealing with the Band of the Red Hand, soldiers know how to cook, they know how to sew, they can wash their own clothes, they know how to take care of a whole bunch of different tasks that might normally be considered women's work, especially if it's a smaller band of soldiers that doesn't normally have camp followers. And while Tam doesn't necessarily come from a background where he would not have had camp followers, he certainly did while he was on campaign for the Aiel War, he is still a capable person who knows how to do a whole bunch of tasks that these good wives say a man can't survive without a woman around to do for him. These two men, this man and his son, are doing fine. Tam might be lonely, he might be, but he is responsible and he is focused on raising a responsible and self-sufficient kid. So Rand is basically an only child who is homeschooled with a stay-at-home dad or a work-from-home dad. Rand works, as Tam does, and learns skills and a profession, and they study books. Rand probably has decent math skills, at least the basics. He knows basic carpentry. No wonder they don't want an outsider. They have a wonderful dynamic and a beautiful relationship. They don't want a stepmom, and it doesn't matter how good she cooks. Only children are closer to their parents because they don't have to share any attention. And there are studies that support this. I mentioned it a couple of episodes ago talking about Nynaeve and her relationship with her father. So Rand is a hardcore daddy's boy. His first instinct when there is any trouble is to look to his father. In the first chapter, as he's walking down the road, it's a really miserable day, and he's super uncomfortable because there's that uneasy feeling in the woods, even before he sees the fade. It says he glanced at his father over the back of the shaggy brown mare. He felt a little foolish about wanting to reassure himself that Tam was still there, but it was that kind of day. My mother had to die for me to be forced to grow up. And that may be an unfair comparison, because I was 26, and Rand is still a kid, and he's in a dangerous and uncomfortable situation, and he's living in a place where there are wolves and bears, there's concerns about food stores and crops not growing before their stores go empty, you know, they have actual existential threats, but be that as it may, if Rand had not left the Two Rivers, he would have gone to Tam for help and advice until the day Tam died, just in the same way that I, even at 43, if my mother were still alive, I would still to this day call her anytime I had a problem and say, "Mom, what do I do?" The closeness that I had with her and the fact that she was my role model and my best friend and the person that I looked to because she knew everything and she had her shit together, and it was so easy to just turn to her for help. And so I was just constantly like, I'll ask my mom. And we had a wonderful relationship, but at the same time, it inhibited my growth. And that's nobody's fault. It's just the way it is. But Rand would always have been a little stunted. There's no way that he could have grown and really become a bigger or more mature person if he had not been able to get away from his father. You have to be able to when you have that kind of a close relationship with a parent like that, and so much of your identity is wrapped up in that parent. You have to have that separation and that distance and learn to do things for yourself and not have that parent there for advice in order to actually be able to become a real adult. I did a little research about kids who lose a parent and grief, and I'll post the actual article in the Podcast of the Dragon Discord in the reference channel. It says, observational studies of children between about 4 years of age and adolescence have led psychiatrists to conflicting conclusions about the nature of children's grieving and about their ability to achieve a healthy outcome. Some psychoanalysts maintain that it is not until adolescence that children have the capacity to tolerate the strong, painful effects necessary for completing the separation process, and that children are more likely to use immature defense mechanisms such as denial that interfere with adequate resolution of loss. Thus, these observers view children's reactions to loss as qualitatively different from adult reactions. Taking this with another part of that article and conflicting conclusions that psychiatrists might have made aside, kids process grief in fits and starts, often very incompletely. And along with that, you have to take Two Rivers' toxic masculinity into account, because no matter how close Tam and Rand are, it's still not really the habit of men in the Two Rivers to talk about their feelings. You work through your feelings. You chop wood. You go out and tend the sheep, you plant the crops, you build the barn. However much they have a good, positive relationship, if you want a picture of men, including Tam, in the Two Rivers dealing with grief, just look at Perrin in The Shadow Rising. When Tam goes to tell him about his family being killed, and he tells him, yeah, I know already, he and Tam and Abel are all standing around quietly and awkwardly, and Perrin even says in his inner narrative, you know, some time alone with a man's thoughts to get past the uncomfortable feelings, and they just don't talk about it. They kind of pretend that they're not feeling things because that's how Two Rivers men deal, or don't actually deal, with their feelings. And so that also stunts any ability to really process. And so Rand, likely because of early loss, but also just because of Two Rivers' toxic masculinity and Two Rivers' stubbornness, is prone to deal with unpleasant realities by wallowing in denial. Looking at what that study says about children's grief and how they don't fully process it, or how their brains are unable to fully process it, RJ shows us that Rand is still affected by his mom's death. Rand comes back to his father to bring the blankets and everything to make the travois to haul him to Emmons Field to the Wisdom. It says, Tam spoke in hushed, hoarse tones. You're still lovely, Carrie. Still lovely as a girl. Rand grimaced. His mother had been dead 15 years. If Tam believed she was still alive, then the fever was even worse than Rand had thought. How could he be kept from speaking now that silence might mean life? Mother wants you to be quiet, Rand whispered. He paused to clear his throat of a sudden tightness. She had had gentle hands. He remembered that much. Carrie wants you to be quiet. Here, drink. Tam gulped thirstily from the water skin, but after a few swallows he turned his head aside and began murmuring softly again, too low for Rand to understand. I think it makes sense that Rand is still sad about it, even all those years later, because, like, you can't remember very well, and so you don't even know totally what you lost. And, you know, I never really thought about that before. I raised my little cousin. They were 8 when I got them, and I got them because my mother died. She and my father took them when they were 6, and so my parents had them for 2 years, and my mom was very much kind of the central figure that they'd imprinted on, and I always assumed that my cousin remembered my mother better than they actually do. But they texted me a while ago, like a couple months ago, wanting to know what my favorite memory of my mother was, and I really couldn't answer the question because I have lots of different memories of my mom, and a lot of them are really simple memories that aren't anything that stand out, just fun things like playing Scrabble and doing laundry together on a Sunday, stuff like that. And my cousin said that they only asked because they have two memories of my mom. And I can't remember what the first one was that they said, something really simple, and then the night that she died. And it didn't occur to me until reading about all of this stuff about kids and grief that my cousin probably never processed things very well. About a year ago, the owner of the company that I up until recently worked for died, and I was really sad to hear it. They called us into a meeting to tell us that he had had a stroke and died. I worked for a family company, a really nice family, and I was very fond of the people. And the owner was a very nice guy, and I liked him quite a lot. I worked there for 10 years, and so I was really sad to hear that he had died. And I ran into my boss's supervisor in the hall afterward, and I happened to be a little choked up about it. And she was pretty upset too, and I was a little surprised because she hadn't worked there for very long. And so we started talking about grief and loss, and I told her that I was very pragmatic in my approach to it. Loss is inevitable. I embrace grief as the price that you pay for loving someone. It sucks and it's horrible, but having experienced a couple of terrible losses in my 20s, like one right on top of the other, 10 months apart, I'm pretty good at processing it. I know that this too shall pass, and I just deal with it fairly well, or I can deal with it in an intellectual fashion. And she commented that she had lost her mother at the age of 5, which is so hard to even imagine. And she told me that any loss that she heard about, somebody lost a pet dog, somebody lost a parent or a grandparent, anything, it just made a wreck of her for the rest of the day. Basically, anybody else's loss, no matter how insignificant, triggered something deep in her, which is logical, having read that article. And understanding that children don't process grief the same way that adults do, or don't process it entirely, a lot of the ways in which grief is listed to have been dealt with in the article that I read are things like anger and accompanying tantrums, sadness, shutting down. And, of course, the big one, at least when it comes to Rand, is denial. The Wheel of Time Companion says about Cari Althor, the daughter of an Andoran merchant from Camelon who ran a trading house in Ilion, she met Tam Althor in 962 NE. Her parents disapproved of her meeting him, opposed her marrying a soldier, and would have stopped it, but were prevented by Tam's position in the Companions. They did disown her, however, when she married him in 965 NE. Cari accompanied Tam on the long campaigns during the Aiel War. They had two children, a girl who died of a fever in infancy and a boy who was stillborn, after which Cari could no longer have children. In late 978 NE, Tam found an infant on the slopes of Dragon Mount and took him to Cari. Shortly after that, Tam resigned his commission and took Cari and baby Rand to the Two Rivers. Cari died of fever in 984 NE. So, Cari met Tam 16 years before Rand's birth and married him 13 years before. It doesn't give an age for her, but I figure she was probably in her mid-30s when Rand was born. It specifically in the Wheel of Time Companion mentions the two children in the sentence after the one about Cari accompanying Tam on the long campaigns during the Aiel War. That doesn't necessarily mean that she had those two children during that time. She could have had them before, and that could just be how the paragraph was written. But I've always wondered how they fed Rand. And I'm sure Tam could easily enough have found a wet nurse in the soldiers' camp, but part of me wonders in my headcanon, had Cari only just recently had the stillborn baby, and was she still lactating? Was she working as a wet nurse? Like, was she in a position where she could feed Rand by herself so that they could leave immediately? Or did they have to hang around so that they had a wet nurse available until he was ready to be weaned? Like, these kinds of practicalities that I would think that Jordan would have thought of, because he normally thinks of everything. So I wonder if there was a specific reason that the children that she had in the Wheel of Time companion entry were mentioned after the Aiel War campaigns. I also wonder why they didn't tell Rand that he was adopted. And I wonder whether they just didn't want to have to tell where they got him, because they were worried if they said, "We have this foundling, we found him at the battle," people would then know that he was the baby of an Aiel, and that would set him up for being shat on and discriminated against, and it was just best to not have that be a thing. And since Kerri has red hair, it's easy enough to pass Rand off as being her natural-born son, and that's just less of a headache for everybody, especially since people will ask questions about where a foundling came from. That's just, you're going to ask questions. People are curious. And if people realize that he's the child of an Aiel, that's going to cause him all kinds of problems, because people think really shitty things about the Aiel, and understandably so. But I also wonder if there was an adoption stigma in the Two Rivers. The Two Rivers seems like a place where fertility is valued, and so adopted children might be seen as less there. It seems to be different in other cultures in Randland. Among Aiel, adoption seems to be very much a thing that is respected. Adopted Aiel children are valued, partly because women like the idea of a chance to foster he who comes with the dawn. Borderlanders also seem to value children who are adopted. At the beginning of the Great Hunt, Rand is brooding about Tam, and it says, Lon seemed to read his mind. In the Borderland sheepherder, if a man has the raising of a child, that child is his, and none can say different. So, maybe in hard lands, where people are prone to lose one or both parents because there's lots of fighting and lots of danger, fostering or adopting is very common and very accepted. So it's like if you raise a child, it's yours and nobody thinks twice about it. Probably everybody knows someone who's adopted, or everybody knows somebody who's raised by someone who's not their parents, because there are a lot of dead parents among Aiel, and there are a lot of dead parents among Borderlanders. Adoption stigma used to be a big thing in the U.S. I found a 1998 article about a slew of what they call late discovery adoptees, and it was people in mid to late middle age at the time, at the end of the 20th century, who learned that they were adopted. All of them had been adopted through the 40s or the early 50s, and when their parents had died, they had come across documents and learned that they were adopted, because infertility was stigmatized at that time in the U.S., and the article said that some women would leave their homes with pillows up under their dresses so it would look like they were preggers, and then they would come back with a baby so people wouldn't know that they were infertile, and then they would never tell their kids that they were adopted. And adoption is still stigmatized. I browsed through some adoptee Reddit threads trying to look for late discovery adoptees to get an idea of what things are like for them today. And I didn't find that so much, but I did find people who were like, oh yeah, I get asked, you know, X, Y, and Z, super offensive things, like, you know, where are your real parents? Just really presumptuous and offensive things. And I'm just kind of like, what a way of treating people as less, treating adoptees as somehow less or less legitimate than people who know or are raised by their birth parents, and also just treating their relationships as less legitimate and valuable, and it's so outrageous. My father is adopted. He was born in 1949 and adopted in 51, I think. I'm pretty sure my grandparents got him when he was 2. And I've never asked him very much about it, partly because I think he's never had a diagnosis, but I'm pretty sure that my father is high-functioning autistic. And my wife agrees with me. She has a friend whose brother has Asperger's, and my father has a lot of the characteristics. And so having to grow up in the 50s and the 60s, having the kinds of behaviors and mannerisms that he has, and doing the types of things with all the kinds of tics that he has, and growing up in a household of really repressed Lutherans, where appearances are very important, it had to have been so difficult. and to be adopted too, so you feel like you probably don't even belong, not only because you're adopted and so you don't look like anybody else, but also people didn't know to appreciate neurodiversity back then. And so rather than, you know, being just even known to be autistic, he was just weird. He doesn't have a diagnosis. I have to tell healthcare providers, I think my father has autism. He's not senile. When they struggle to have conversations with him, you know, he's in his 70s now and he has health problems. And I have this conversation every time and they think that he might have some level of dementia. And I have to be like, no, he really, I swear to God, does not have any kind of dementia. I think he's just got Asperger's or something. And that's just kind of how he is. That's how he communicates. I've never talked to my father about how he feels about being adopted, but I can guess at his feelings because I know that I was a surprise pregnancy. And for some reason, it never occurred to my mother's doctor when he was trying to figure out why she was throwing up that it might be a pregnancy. He didn't give her a pregnancy test until she had only 11 days left to decide whether she was going to terminate the pregnancy or not. And so she and my father were discussing the options, and when she mentioned adoption, my father was vehemently against it. He basically was sort of like he would not let someone else raise his child. He supported her if she wanted to have an abortion, but if she didn't want to raise the baby and she wanted to give birth to me, he would have raised me by himself, and he was dirt poor, but he would have bent over backwards to raise me, and presumably my mother would have had to pay child support because he was not going to let his kid be raised by someone else. So he has very strong feelings about it that I've never probed because, I don't know, I feel like it's his business. It just seems presumptuous to probe. Upon discovering that they are adopted, a lot of people who were late discovery adoptees feel pain, shock, confusion, and denial, and a total loss of identity. What I have read has shown that what Rand first goes through seems to be a pretty typical reaction. It says here, Tam was talking again, he realized, sometimes only murmuring, sometimes loud enough to understand. From time to time he stopped to pant for breath, then went on as if he thought he had been speaking the whole time. Battles are always hot, even in the snow. Sweat heat, blood heat. Only death is cool. Slope of the mountain, only place didn't stink of death. Had to get away from the smell of it, sight of it. Heard a baby cry. Their women fight alongside the men sometimes, but why they'd let her come, I don't. Gave birth there alone before she died of her wounds. Covered the child with her cloak, but the wind blown the cloak away. Child blew with the cold. Should have been dead too. Crying there, crying in the snow. I couldn't just leave a child. No children of our own. Always knew you wanted children. I knew you'd take it to your heart, Carrie. Yes, lass. Rand is a good name. A good name. Suddenly, Rand's legs lost the little strength they had. Stumbling, he fell to his knees. Tam moaned with the jolt, and the strip of blanket cut into Rand's shoulders, but he was not aware of either. If a Trolloc had leaped up in front of him right then, he would just have stared at it. He looked over his shoulder at Tam, who had sunk back into wordless murmurs. Fever dreams, he thought dully. Fevers always brought bad dreams, and this was a night for nightmares, even without a fever. You are my father, he said aloud, stretching back a hand to touch Tam, and I am... The fever was worse, much worse. Grimly, he struggled to his feet. Tam murmured something, but Rand refused to listen to any more. Throwing his weight against the improvised harness, he tried to put all of his mind into taking one leaden step after another, into reaching the safety of Emmons Field, but he could not stop the echo in the back of his mind. He's my father. It was just a fever dream. He's my father. It was just a fever dream. Light, who am I? That is traumatic enough in the best of times. But when it has just been you and your dad for 15 years, and you were so bonded... Rand's identity is wrapped up in his father. Right away, upon hearing this unwelcome news, he just deflects and denies. It can't be true. as he gets Tam to the wine spring inn after Nynaeve says she can't heal him, and they're up in the room, and Tom Maryland is kind of steering Bran Alvear towards suggesting that Ran ask Moraine to heal Tam by being like, I wonder who put the dragon's fang on the door of the inn. It says, Rand gave him a disgusted look and turned away to stare into the fire. His thoughts danced like the flames, and like the flames they concentrated fixedly on one thing. He would not give up. He could not just stand there and watch him die. My father, he thought fiercely. My father. Once the fever was gone, that could be cleared up as well. And when he brings Moraine to heal Tam, it says, while he was coming through the door, Rand's eyes went to his father. His father, no matter what anyone said. Even though Tam is the only one who said that he wasn't his father. And as she's getting ready to heal Tam, she tells Rand and Bran to get out. And it says, can I stay? Rand spoke to Moraine, though she did not really seem to be aware of anyone besides Tam. Bran's hand tightened, but Rand ignored him. Please, I'll keep out of your way. You won't even know I'm here. He's my father, he added with a fierceness that startled him and widened the mayor's eyes in surprise. Rand hoped the others put it down to tiredness or the strain of dealing with an Aes Sedai. His head is just filled with, he's my father no matter what, no matter what anybody says, even though Tam is the only one who said, I'm not your father. And he's got that fierce possessiveness, and he's like, once the fever's taken care of, it can be cleared up. But Tam wakes up after he's been healed, and Rand has a chance to clear the air with him, but he doesn't take it because he doesn't actually want to know. And so he leaves the Two Rivers, and he leaves with Tam's sword. And I've never really paid much attention to symbolism in the Wheel of Time. I've always focused on foreshadowing, and my big obsession is more point of view, because as I've said many times before, I love RJ's use of point of view and how he uses it for character development. And I just love diving into the characters and feeling so much empathy for them and trying to imagine what's going on with them far beyond what he actually tells you. But the symbolism with Tam's sword, it's this talisman, this representation of his dad, which is more important to him than anything, where his inner narrative is whispering the truth at him so much that he has to be constantly denying it because he doesn't want to believe. He's turning his head away and gripping the sword for reinforcement and just thinking, my father, my father, my father. The sword is his symbol for Tam, his security blanket, his substitute for dad, and so whenever he is faced with giving it up, he vehemently refuses. He won't trade it to Bael Doman for passage down the RNL. Bael's like, well, you've got to pay for your passage. I see one of your apprentices has a sword and I could use one, and Rand's like, fuck you. When he's talking to Matt, being like, yo, why don't you sell that dagger? We could get a fuck ton of money for the ruby. We could fucking take a carriage all the way to Tar Valon. And Matt's like, hey, kiss my ass. You sell your sword. And Rand's like, yo, I wouldn't ask you to sell something that your dad gave you. This isn't just a sword. That's just a fucking knife. And it's a beautiful, expensive one, but it has no sentimental value. This is something my father gave me. You know, this is my substitute dad. And he refuses when he gets to Camelin to take Almond Bunt's advice. Almond drives them the last leg of the trip to Camelin, and once he gets there, he's like, yo, you should probably get rid of the Harrenmark sword. Because Bunt was watching the innkeeper Holdwyn talking to the Fade, and then afterwards he's kind of needling Holdwyn about it, and Holdwyn says he's looking for some thieves who stole a Harrenmark sword. And then Rand approaches Bunt and says, can you give us a ride to Camelin? So when Bunt drops them off, he asks, hey, is that thing under your cloak what Holdwyn said it was? And Rand's like, what do you mean? And Bunt tells him that maybe he should get rid of it. It says, staying unnoticed was something Rand thought about a great deal. He kept his cloak over his sword, but that would not be good enough for very long. Sooner or later, someone would wonder what he was hiding. He would not, could not, take Bunt's advice to stop wearing it, not his link to Tam. To his father. Because at that point, it's kind of like, it's what gives him the right. As it says in the first chapter of The Great Hunt, as long as I keep it, I have the right to call Tam father. He gave it to me, and it gives me the right. So Jordan beats us over the head with Tam is my father because we have the unreliable narrator, and that is Rand's mantra. And so while I think it would be poor writing if we were having a third-person omniscient POV giving us this repeating, Tam is Rand's father, and finding out he's adopted has made Rand very upset, and he can't accept it even though he knows deep down that it's true, and hearing that over and over again, from a third-person limited point of view, it really does illustrate and break down the desperation Rand has to hold on to his sense of identity, to hold on to this connection to his father. And when you think about the kind of relationship that they have had for 15 years where it's just the two of them, he is not himself without his father, which isn't totally healthy, even though it's a happy and positive relationship. I mean, it's not fantastic to have your entire identity wrapped up in your parent, and it's good to get away from your parent and grow on your own because it forces you to make decisions for yourself. And Tam is the type of dad who would make sure that Rand engaged in critical thinking skills and wouldn't have been a helicopter parent and constantly do everything for him. So I feel like he would have tried to strike a reasonable balance. Rand isn't a helpless baby. He can take care of himself. But even so, Tam felt like the world outside the Two Rivers was no place for Rand and that he should really be going with him because he felt like nothing could prepare Rand for that. So for personal growth, getting away from his father was absolutely necessary, and there's no need for death to divide them like in many stories. Distance will do for one, and the shocking loss of identity, Tam's feverish confession in the dark, will do the rest. The story that Rand is telling himself constantly through Book One is, Tam is my father. The repeat refrain that he frustrates us with through Book Two is, I am not the dragon. I said before that I think that Rand has all the building blocks for mental illness, even without channeling Sidine. This refusal that he has to live in reality and face facts because they're just too painful to deal with definitely speaks to having anxiety or depression, and so does his tendency to talk shit to himself and to punish himself. We spent the majority of the first book in a cycle of grief and denial inside his head, and occasionally punishing thoughts where he'll say shitty stuff to himself, and it's probably partly under the influence of the Shatter Logoth dagger when he's on the journey with Matt and he's thinking things to himself like, even if you go into this village, Tam isn't going to be there and it's all too late now, and just really negative thoughts. But we see it even before with things like when he's coming back toward the house when the Trollocs are attacking and he crawls over the hoe handle and it freaks him the fuck out and he calls himself an idiot. Like, over and over again, he just talks shit to himself in a way that isn't common among the other boys. Some of the other characters do it, so it might be part of Two Rivers culture, but Perrin doesn't really do it. Matt doesn't do it. You know, someone might call themselves a fool in a more general way, but it's kind of a way to say, yo, I'm being dumb, as opposed to this lashing out and punishing yourself that Rand does. He really does punish himself. We spent the majority of the first book in a cycle of shock and grief and denial, but he faces no true challenges to his whole it's just a fever dream self-deception until he hits Caitlin. And then in quick succession, he hears from Loyal that he looks like an Aiel. And then when he falls into the palace, Elida, Morghese, and the rest express great skepticism that he's from the Two Rivers. He's like, I'm a shepherd from the Two Rivers. And Elida is like, with that skin and your red hair, bullshit. And they're all like, yeah, we don't believe you. And if it's not for the fact that Morghese has heard a Two Rivers accent, and from that is able to fairly determine that he's probably being truthful about everything, it would be a given assumption that he's lying, which is so disorienting. If you've ever had someone assume that you're lying when you're not, it is hard to cope with. You can't fight that. But once he gets to Caitlin and he meets more worldly people than the ones that he's running into on the road who are all like, yo, it's not just that you don't look like you're from the Two Rivers, you specifically look like an Aielman. So he's faced with Tam's fevered confession, which he cannot unhear, and now he has the observations and assumptions of others and their surprise and disbelief that he is not who he says he is. And this moves into the Great Hunt with people continuing not to believe that he is who he says he is. he gets slapped with the label of Lord Rand, and maybe the most frustrating thing about that for him is that a lord is not a shepherd. There's no line to draw from a lord to a shepherd, and it's therefore like he has no claim to Tam. So it's not just that he doesn't want to be treated like a lord because that's not who he is, or the fact that to him it's just ridiculous that the owl in his name is what's making all of these stupid servants think that he's a lord, or that this rumor's going around. It's like his grasp on his father is so tenuous at this point that he cannot bear creating this greater separation with Lord Rand, where it's like, what? No, no, what the fuck? Shut up! It says he was a farmer from the Two Rivers, so far away now, maybe far away forever now. He was a shepherd like his father. I was a shepherd. What am I now? And his father had given him a heron-marked sword. Tam is my father, no matter what anybody says. He wished his own thoughts did not sound as if he was trying to convince himself. And then right after that, Lon says, yo, if he raised you, he's your dad, shithead. Rand continues over the course of the Great Hunt to hear that he looks like an Aiel. At first he thinks that when he gets the stink eye from some of the Shinarans in the keep, it's just because he's an outlander and that some of them don't want to accept him. And he thinks to himself that plenty of them do accept him. Most of them do. He trains with Lon. Lord Agamar has him at table. And so they accept him with a few exceptions. And so he doesn't think anything more of it. He has no knowledge of the hostility and animosity Shinarans have toward Aiel because they share a border with them and fight them on a regular basis outside of the Aiel War. And it just doesn't occur to him. Even though at this point he's heard that he looks like an Aielman. And so as they make camp after their first day hunting the horn, and Massima has thrown hot stew on him, and he goes to sit down and is talking to Ingtar, he says, Massima acts like he hates me, and I don't understand it. Massima served 3 years in the Eastern Marches, Ingtar said, at Angkor Dale against the Aiel. He stirred his stew with his spoon, frowning. I ask no questions, mind. If Lon Daishan and Moraine Sedai want to say you are from Andor, from the Two Rivers, then you are. But Massima can't get the look of the Aiel out of his head, and when he sees you, he shrugged. I ask no questions. Rand dropped his spoon in the plate with a sigh. Everybody thinks I'm somebody I am not. I am from the Two Rivers, Ingtar. I grew tobacco with my father and tended his sheep. That is what I am, a farmer and shepherd from the Two Rivers. He's from the Two Rivers, Matt said scornfully. I grew up with him, though you'd never know it now. You put this Aiel nonsense in his head on top of what's already there, and the light knows what we'll have, an Aiel lord, maybe. No, Loyal said. He has the look. You remember, Rand, I remarked on it once, though I thought it was just because I didn't know you humans well enough then. Remember? Till shade is gone, till water is gone. Into the shadow with teeth bared, screaming defiance with the last breath to spit in Sightblinder's eye on the last day. You remember, Rand? Rand stared at his plate. Wrap a shufa around your head, and you would be the image of an Aielman. That had been Gawain, brother to Elaine, the daughter heir of Andor. Everybody thinks I'm somebody I'm not. At this point, the news that he looks like an Aiel is especially unwelcome, because that very day, as he is eating the stew that was thrown on him in what was more or less a hate crime, earlier that day, he had the horrible meeting with the Amyrlin, Moraine, and Varen, where Moraine breaks down the Battle of the Shining Walls, and you get Rand's inner narrative as she's telling the story, kind of repeating his dad's fevered ramblings in his head while he's interrupting her and speaking these words of denial, like it was a fever dream, he just had a fever dream, as she's basically telling him the story. The Aiel came over the Dragon Wall, and he's hearing they came over the Dragon Wall like a flood. And it was so dickish the way that it was done, because they softened him up first with information to show that they knew more about his father than he did. So the Amyrlin's talking about his sword. It says, this sword, the Amyrlin seat said. It appears to be a heron-marked blade. How did he come by that, Moraine? Tam Althor left the Two Rivers as a boy, mother. He joined the army of Ilion and served in the White Cloak War and the last two wars with Tyr. In time, he rose to be a blade master and the second captain of the Companions. After the Aiel War, Tam-Althor returned to the Two Rivers with a wife from Camelin and an infant boy. It would have saved much had I known this earlier, but I know it now. Rand stared at Moraine. He knew Tam had left the Two Rivers and come back with an Outlander wife and the sword, but the rest... Where did you learn all that? Not in Emmon's Field, unless Nynaeve told you more than she's ever told me. An infant boy. She doesn't say his son, but I am. Against Tyr, the Ammerlin Seat frowned slightly. Well, there was blame enough on both sides in those wars. Fool men who would rather fight than talk. Can you tell if the blade is authentic, Varen? There are tests, mother. Then take it and test it, daughter. The three women were not even looking at him. Rand stepped back, gripping the hilt hard. My father gave this sword to me, he said angrily. Nobody is taking it from me. They can pry his link to Tam from his cold, dead hands. And then Swan just casually slaps him with the 1-2 punch of, Yo, I know you can channel, and yeah, I'm not going to gentle you because you're the Dragon Reborn, which just adds a whole new level to his identity crisis. It just ratchets it up, you know. It's like, you've heard that your father isn't your father. You've been living with that for a couple of months now, and yeah, that's really upsetting, and you want to deny it, but now everybody's telling you you don't look like you're from the Two Rivers, you look like an Aiel. And now we're going to tell you you're the Dragon Reborn, and that's the reason the Trollocs came after you. And because he does not want to be the Dragon Reborn, he doesn't want to believe them, and also because they were dicks. And because he let Balzamon get under his skin with all of the dreams that he had in the first book, and with the false dragon, the Aes Sedai will use you narrative, Rand tells himself that they're lying. It's easier to think that they're lying. It's more comfortable. It's what he wants to believe. He wants it to be a lie. If he's the Dragon Reborn, then Tam isn't his dad, and he can't deal with that. When the hunters go to Steading Sofu to get permission to use the Waygate so they can follow Fane and the Horn to Tommen Head, they run into Aiel Maidens of the Spear, who have supposedly come to trade for Sung Wood, and they all almost kill each other before the Ogier come running and are like, Yo, what the fuck? Stop fighting. This is bullshit. And Perrin says, yeah, bullshit, that they're trading for Sung Wood. They're looking for He Who Comes with the Dawn. And Matt's like, yeah, they're looking for you, Rand. What do you mean they're looking for me? Why? For what reason? They looked right at me and went away. They looked at you, Matt said with a grin, like you hadn't bathed in a month and had doused yourself with sheep dip besides. His grin faded. But they could be looking for you. We met another Aiel. Rand listened in growing amazement to their tale of the meeting and Kinslayer's dagger. Matt told most of it, with Perrin putting in a correcting word now and again when he embellished too much. Matt made a great show of how dangerous the Aielmen had been and how close the meeting had come to a fight. And since you're the only Aiel we know, he finished, well, it could be you. Ingtar says Aiel never live outside the Waste, so you must be the only one. I don't think that's funny, Matt, Rand growled. I am not an Aiel. The Ammerlin said you are. Ingtar thinks you are. Tam said he was sick. Fevered. They had severed the roots he had thought he had, the Aes Sedai and Tam between them, though Tam had been too sick to know what he was saying. They had cut him loose to tumble before the wind, then offered him something new to hold on to. False dragon. Aiel. He could not claim those for roots. He would not. Maybe I don't belong to anyone, but the Two Rivers is the only home I know. And I like how he does acknowledge that Tam, as well as the Aes Sedai, are responsible for cutting his roots, but he blames Moraine and the Aes Sedai for his identity crisis, as if Tam wasn't the one who told him first. You know, he acknowledges Tam's fault, but gives him a pass because he knows that he didn't do it with malintent. He's ascribing malintent to the Aes Sedai because he doesn't like what they have to say. And at the point that he has this thought that the Aes Sedai and Tam have severed his roots and sent him drifting and given him things like False Dragon and Aiel to cling to, he's already had the first Herrenbrand on his palm, and Tom has told him the prophecy of twice and twice shall he be marked, twice to live and twice to die. Balzamon at this point has called him the dragon. When he gets the first Herrenbrand, when he and Loyal and Huron are in the mirror world and he is standing guard and the mist comes up, And I don't know if Ishamael has pulled him into a dream shard. RJ is never super clear about how that stuff happens in the first three books, but he is walking a perimeter and Balzamon shows up and it says, "Balzamon," he breathes, "this is a dream. It has to be. I fell asleep." And Balzamon laughed like the roar of an open furnace. "You always try to deny what is, Luce Theron. If I stretch out my hand, I can touch you, Kinslayer. I can always touch you, always and everywhere. I am not the dragon. My name is Randall." Rand clamped his teeth shut to stop himself. "Oh, I know the name you use now, Luce Theron. I know every name you have used through age after age, long before you were even the Kinslayer." So now you have Balzamon actually calling him Luce Theron, which he wasn't in the last book, because he didn't know which of the three boys was the dragon until the very end. And it's like, at least when it comes to him saying, "I'm not the dragon, my name is Randall Thar, shut the fuck up," at least the father of lies, as he assumes that Balzamon is, at least he's someone you're not supposed to believe when he tells you things. Though it would have been nice if Rand had remembered that when he started buying hook, line, and sinker his bullshit about the Aes Sedai wanting to use him as a false dragon. All of the doubts that he seeded in Rand that made him so deeply mistrustful of Moraine and her motivations. Not that it's a bad thing to be mistrustful of Aes Sedai somewhat, but and not that Moraine didn't deserve for him to be suspicious of her, since she dealt so poorly with him, but the credit or the weight that he gave to the things that Balzamon said to him kind of makes Rand a dumbass. But as much as I want to punch Rand's face for his obnoxiously persistent denial, if someone were trying to force a job on me that I didn't want, or take from me an identity that I had had my whole life, and thrust upon me one that made me feel wrong-footed and ill-qualified and, you know, doomed to wreak havoc and destruction and horror on the world, I'm a stubborn motherfucker, and I might refuse to cooperate with Destiny too, and be like, you know, nope, that's not how it is, and I'm not gonna do it, and I'm not listening, and fuck you all. And in the end, this is the story of someone who lived a life, as everyone is supposed to, filled with self-determination. The first 19 years of his life were filled with self-determination. It may not have been very interesting self-determination, like, you know, I'm going to milk the cow first and then gather the eggs, and I'm going to talk to my dad about him hoeing the garden so I can mend the fence instead, and I'm going to finish The Travels of Jane Farstrider and then start reading it again, and I'm going to argue with Egwene because we're supposed to get married, but we don't want the same things. And I'm going to hang out with Matt and Perrin, and we're going to be immature dicks because we're dumb. But nonetheless, a life filled with self-determination, however uninteresting. And Rand resents being told that he's destined to do anything except be on the farm with his dad, who, with all props to Matt and Perrin, is his best friend. Tam is his best friend. Tam is the most important person in his life. If he had to choose one person to go be stuck on a desert island with, it would be Tam. Tam is the one that he values the most. And maybe that is why RJ needed to have the Horn of Valyr in his plot, because I can't think of another logical reason for it to exist, but for him to rescue himself after painting himself into a corner with this incredibly stubborn character who is pathologically unwilling to admit that he's the dragon, because if he admits that he's the dragon, then he has to admit that his father is not his father, and that's too painful, because people who discover that they're adopted late in life feel shocked and betrayed and confused, and like they're completely adrift and they don't know who they are, and they feel like everything is a lie, and it's sad and terrifying. And so to have that happen, even in an ordinary life, if life hadn't changed in any way and he had found that out, it would have been traumatic enough. So learning that information and having everything else go to shit as well, so much in Rand's life goes to shit. And I think sometimes people know that, but they don't know that because they don't take the time to imagine what it must be like even before he really realizes and acknowledges that he's the dragon. just to have knowledge that you're doomed to insanity. You know, I'm one of those people who was fortunate enough that I respond very well to medication, and I can't imagine being someone who doesn't. I'm so lucky, because I know that there are people who don't, and it's terrible, because the idea of being destined to get crazier and crazier, which is even worse than just not being able to get better, to get crazier and crazier to the point where you don't know what you're doing, and, you know, maybe you're not necessarily destined to hurt everyone. People in saying that the dragon was destined to destroy the world because of the way that the breaking of the world came about assumed that it was in ways of using the one power to engage in destructive physical acts, not really thinking about the more political upheaval and the war and the change and all of that. That really is what it means for him to destroy the world, to break everything and rebuild it. So having to deal with just that small notion of being doomed to lose your mind, having all of that weight, and then not even knowing who you really are, but the person that they tell you you are is someone that you can't bear to think of being, because it's someone hated and reviled. It's bad enough that you're a man who can channel. That's bad enough. But you have to be the worst man who can channel ever? On top of losing your identity? It's like, okay, you lost who you thought you were. So we'll shuffle through and give you an identity. Look, here's one, it's utter shit. And he just can't deal. But the purpose of the horn, I almost feel like, is that Ran wouldn't trust anyone, and he wouldn't believe anyone, because there is no living human person who would not have some agenda in telling him that he's the dragon. And so the only way that he could really truly believe it is if a ghost army came and misty people with nothing to gain told him the truth. So Hawkwing says, "Something holds me." Suddenly he turned his sharp-eyed gaze on Rand. "You are here. Have you the banner?" A murmur ran through those behind him. "Yes." Rand tore open the straps of his saddlebags and pulled out the dragon's banner. It filled his hand and hung almost to his stallion's knees. The murmur among the heroes arose. "The pattern weaves itself around our necks like halters," Ardor Hawkwing said. "You are here. The banner is here. The weave of this moment is set. We have come to the horn, but we must follow the banner and the dragon." And even then, Rand does not want to let go of his denial. He wakes 3 days after the battle. They've traveled east of Falma, and he wakes up. Min is there, and it says, he raised his hands to run them over his face and stopped, staring at his palms in shock. There was a heron branded across his left palm, too, now, to match the one on his right, every line clean and true. Once the heron to set his path, twice the heron to name him true. No! And a little further on, once Moraine comes and talks to him, she tells him, "The pattern weaves itself around you even more tightly," Moraine said. "You need me now more than ever." "I don't need you," he said harshly, "and I don't want you. I will not have anything to do with this." He remembered being called Luz Theron, not only by Baalzamon, but by Ardor Hawkwing. "I won't. Light the dragon is supposed to break the world apart, to tear everything apart. I will not be the dragon." And Moraine has produced Rand's sword, which, despite being power wrought and supposedly indestructible, melted when he stabbed it into Baalzamon's chest. And I'm wondering if somehow, at the point that Ishamael has used enough of the true power that he's gone from having saw in his eyes to complete endless caverns of flame in his face, does that make it somehow like he has caverns of flame in his entire self, like he's just internally inflamed, so that at the point that the power wrought sword stabs into his chest, it melts because of some contact with the true power? I don't know exactly how that might have worked, but that's my best guess, is that the only reason that it got melted is because of some contact with the true power. But it's perfect symbolism, because all along this item that he clung to, that his father gave him, that he won't trade or sell, that he won't let anybody take from him, is destroyed when he is proclaimed in the skies over Tommen Head. It says, For a moment he stood, staring down at the hair on Mark's sword, what was left of it, lying on the ground. Tam's sword. My father's sword. Reluctantly, more reluctantly than he had ever done anything in his life, he let go of the hope that he would discover Tam really was his father. It felt as if he were tearing his heart out. Then, to give the last bit of separation after this acceptance that Tam isn't really his father, this tearing away and destruction of identity, the Shinarans come and kneel before him, so that Rand is now completely and totally an other. It's not just that he knows that he's an other because he knows that he's a man that can channel, but now everybody else knows that he's an other. Not just because they know that he's a man that can channel, but that he is the dragon. And how weird to have men that you figured didn't even respect you and looked sideways at you because you got named the second when you're so fucking unqualified and you know they must have wondered what the hell, to have them kneel, to have anyone kneel before him, because being Lord Rand made him uncomfortable enough. It says, "We would pledge ourselves to you," Uno said. The others kneeling with him nodded. "Your oaths are to Ingtar and Lord Agelmar," Rand protested. "Ingtar died well, Uno. He died so the rest of us could escape with the horn." There was no need to tell them or anyone else the rest. He hoped that Ingtar had found the light again. "Tell Lord Agelmar that when you return to Faldara." "It is said," the one-eyed man said carefully, "that when the dragon is reborn, he will break all oaths, shatter all ties. Nothing holds us now. We would give our oaths to you." He drew his sword and laid it before him, hilt toward Rand, and the rest of the Shinarans did the same. "You battled the Dark One," Massima said. Massima, who hated him. Massima, who looked at him as if seeing a vision of the light. "I saw you, Lord Dragon. I saw. I am your man to the death." His dark eyes shone with fervor. "You must choose, Rand," Moraine said. "The world will be broken, whether you break it or not. Tarman Gaiden will come, and that alone will tear the world apart. Will you still try to hide from what you are, and leave the world to face the last battle undefended? Choose." They were all watching him, all waiting. "Death is lighter than a feather, duty heavier than a mountain." He made his decision. In a fantastical fantasy, this would give way to a Zen state of acceptance. Finally acknowledging the truth and agreeing that he's the dragon would be accompanied with a calm shouldering of duty and inner peace like what we get at Veins of Gold, literally 9 books later. Instead, Rand is pushed to a really terrible place mentally. He is now an other, and he will spend the entire next book in a state of borderline psychosis, full of anxiety and desperation, and I prefer that. He's just been told that his presence, the very rumor of him, sets off chaos and ruin, and that was one reason he did not want to be the dragon. That's not okay. He is a nice, sweet person that doesn't want to hurt anyone and doesn't want to destroy anything, and it's not okay. He's not okay. And this descent into not being okay for Rand is just beginning.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Podcast of the Dragon. I feel like it was a great way to wrap up the Great Hunt, and now I'm going to be taking a month or so off so I can do some homeschooling, learn some cool stuff, and get prepared for the Dragon Reborn, get some good episodes out for you. I'm going to get my Patreon set up, and so I'll have some good bonus stuff. There's a link in the show notes for The Way of the Leaf, the Leafcast Tavern Talk. Last Sunday I was on, I had a really good time with Brother Dan and Ryan, so you should check it out for some inappropriate discussions about sex and the One Power, as well as talk of Two Rivers Justice, Pillow Friends, the Red Aja, all kinds of good stuff. I recently recorded an episode with the Wheel of Time Spoilers podcast, which should drop soon, and when it does, I'll put it up as a bonus podcast with links to my previous Wheel of Time Spoilers guest episodes. You can find me on Twitter at WarderGray, that's Gray with an E. There are links in the show notes to my Discord, to my email, to Watt Trivia and Games if you want to go hang out with cool people and play some games, to the Watt Fandom and Calendar if you want to find a whole bunch of other Wheel of Time content creators. My music is by Kevin MacLeod. I'm the Grey Warder, and unlike Rand, if 20 strapping men knelt at my feet and swore devotion, my first instinct would not be to protest.